All right, let me paint you a picture. It's late at night. You're scrolling through your feeds when all of a sudden you see it, that one product you've been looking for or that's been chasing you around the internet. You click on the link, add to cart, maybe even shop around a little more before finally hitting checkout. As you're filling in your address, you realize you don't have your card anywhere. How are you supposed to pay? You can't tap to pay. That's when you see it, that purple pay button that has all of your information saved, making checking out as simple as a simple tap of your screen. That's Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names just like American Hauntings Clothing to brands just getting started. Best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. What if people haven't heard about my brand? Well, nobody knew about my brand for a long time. But Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns. You can see less carts go abandoned and more sales go with Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. Again, that's shopify.com/hauntings.
Before we get started with this week's episode, I wanted to offer all of you an apology for not posting a new episode until now. I actually did post this episode 2 weeks ago on my way to Los Angeles to do some more filming for the History Channel, but there was a technical glitch of some kind and we had to take it down, and I was on my way out the door. So I'm just now getting back into town, getting caught up, and have finally been able to update the episode. So I'm sorry about that, but I hope you liked this first part of what will be a recurring number of episodes about the devil in the movies. Oh, and one last thing. If you like my stories about devils, demons, and sinister events, you're going to like my latest book, which is called In a Dark Place. It's a collection of sinister hauntings, possessions, and poltergeists, and it's one of those books you don't want to read alone. Pre-orders for the book start this Monday, April 6th, so keep an eye out for that. All right, thanks, and now on with the show. American pop culture in the 1920s and 30s was on the verge of a new sort of entertainment. Cultural shifts and breakthroughs in technology had led to a steady stream of new kinds of books, comics, music, and magazines, but it would be film that transformed popular culture forever. The ghostly images watched with strangers in the dark soon proved to be powerful enough to incite as well as to entertain. Soon after films gained popularity, Americans began to use them to frame their history and their identity, as well as to literally project their fears and anxieties. And among those fears were the fear of the devil. When the devil first began to appear in early American movies, his story was part of a heavily Christianized moral lesson. The same couldn't be said for Europe, where filmmakers were using satanic lore to create fantastic and uncanny imagery. In the United States, even though the new silent films were the scourge of the Christian community, our movies were much tamer and much more puritanical. They steered mostly clear of explicitly supernatural subjects and used theaters as fire and brimstone pulpits instead. Well, at first, anyway. Because as the imagery on screen eventually began to reflect satanic themes, audiences responded, and darker days for the cinema were soon on the way. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. In this episode, we return to our exploration of the devil, the diabolical figure that has been the source of so many of America's fears. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 16, The Devil Goes to the Movies. American popular culture during the first three decades of the last century was on the verge of a new period of entertainment. Cultural shifts and breakthroughs in technology, as mentioned already, led to a steady stream of different kinds of information and entertainment. But it would be film, the movies, that transformed what we think of as popular culture for good. Ghostly images on screen, watched in the dark with strangers, proved powerful enough to entertain and inspire. As films grew in popularity, Americans began to use them to frame their history and their identity, as well as, I mentioned, literally project their fears and anxieties on the screen. One of America's great fears was of any race other than their own. Many early silent films conveyed that terror, insisting that other races were the enemies of the white American identity. No film better illustrated the kind of white terror that simmered in the country, like W.D. Griffith's 1915 film, Birth of a Nation. While regarded as a landmark motion picture, it's also notorious for attempting to retell the story of America's founding through a white supremacist lens. The film was a hit and had a stunning effect on real life when it helped inspire the revival of a new version of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia that same year. After being popularized in the mainstream, the Klan's intolerance for African Americans, Jews, Catholics, and immigrants of every kind became acceptable. And soon the ranks of the hate group swelled to record numbers and included ministers, businessmen, politicians, and city leaders. But fear of this so-called other wasn't the only great fear addressed by films. Another American terror was, of course, the devil. The social upheaval of the time, which included World War I and the Roaring Twenties, forced many Christians to defend their cultural values against the changes of the early 20th century. They went to war against what they saw as the sinful modern world. And thanks to the growing fundamentalist and Pentecostal movements, the theme of spiritual warfare began appearing in many different forms of entertainment, including in the movies. The filmmaking community in Europe was embracing the devil and uncanny imagery in films like Faust, A Student of Prague, and The Golem, but for the most part, early American films avoided supernatural subjects, using, as I mentioned, the theater as sort of a church pulpit. A perfect example of this was 1915's The Devil, directed by Thomas Ince. Although based on a Hungarian play, the plot's dour warning about the mortal sin of adultery was perfectly suited for American sensibilities at the time. In the film, the devil, played by Edward Connolly, is an elegantly dressed society type, and he appears in an artist's studio to encourage him to hook up with an old flame who happens to be happily married. The rest is melodrama and ends with the lovers being punished for their sinfulness by being sent to hell. In 1915, Thomas Edison produced a film called The Magic Skin, directed by Richard Ridgely. It's about a young musician in Paris who's lovesick over a woman who doesn't want him. But after falling asleep while visiting an antique store, he wakes to find that the devil is the shop's proprietor, who accepts the young man's soul in exchange for a skin with the power to grant any wish, although each one comes at a price. Soon his health is ruined, the woman he wanted and won has left him, and the sweet girl he jilted has killed herself in despair. And frightened away after his final wish is gone, the skin quickly marries the nice girl, and the unlucky swearing to lead an finds upright himself life in hell after that. To atone
now, this
for
will not be the last time that a meeting with the devil turns out to be a dream, particularly in this subgenre of satanic films as moral lessons. Edison also produced The Devil's Castle, which most film historians believe marks the first American film appearance of the devil looking like, well, the devil, you know, with horns and a tail and cloven hooves. Created by Manhattan filmmakers Albert E. Smith and J. Stuart Blackton, it was a simple showcase for stop-motion trickery. And as was so often the case, the young soldier who encounters the devil in the title's castle awakens to find it was all a dream. Soon after, director Frederick Armitage introduced a pair of interlinked supernatural satanic films called The Prince of Darkness and The Terrible Night. But the second film wins the award for being the very first little more than short novelty flicks, long before Friday the 13th, black-clad, caped, horned, and goateed devil is reduced to spook show antics of scaring a drunk in the first film and terrifying a sleeping man in the sequel. Both Tame Terror films were filmed on the same identical set. Armitage later directed an Edison-produced version of Faust, which was just one of the classics that were sought out as source material during the first two decades of film. They rarely ever offered original plots, which meant that filmmakers rarely told stories of the cults that worshiped the devil, which would become a staple of satanic cinema in the decades to come. Now, one notable exception to this is 1916's The Mysteries of Myra, which included the first time a satanic cult appeared on screen. The directing team of Theodore and Leopold Wharton broke the pattern of setting all devil-related films in the distant past. This story was told in the modern day, and the movie's cult, called the Black Order, was presented as a menacing coven of black-robed devil worshippers. Throughout a series of cliffhanger episodes, the mysteries that Myra encounters include such genuine occult phenomena as a vampiric spirit conjured from the thoughts of sorcerers, crystal gazing, astral travel, and automatic writing. Real-life paranormal investigator Hereward Carrington brought these elements to the production, and the cult's enemy, Dr. Payson Alden, who was the first of many cinematic paranormal experts to use science and reason to defeat the forces of black magic, was based on Carrington, who was the author of many books on psychic phenomena, poltergeists, and magic. Dr. Alden and his adversary, the cult's grandmaster, fight a battle for the soul of the title heroine, Myra, who was played by Jean Southern. Interestingly, the cult leader, played by Michael W. Rale, was based on Aleister Crowley, who had been cultivating a reputation as a black magician and the most evil man in the world for years. Carrington was an admiring acquaintance of Crowley, and the hand gesture used by the villain in the series was taken directly from one of the most widely circulated portraits of Crowley at the time. That same year also saw the release of The Devil's Bondswoman, in which Adele Farrington plays a woman so evil she gets the attention of the devil, who carries her off to hell at the film's conclusion. This picture was just one of hundreds of American films made at this time that warned of another of society's fear, the dangers of the newly emancipated woman, the American woman who could smoke, drink, cut her hair, wear short skirts, vote, and acted like a man. They were often referred to as vamps, and were most notably portrayed on screen by Theda Bara, whose entire persona was built around occult mystery. At the height of her fame, Theda, whose real name was Theodosia Goodman, was one of the most popular movie stars in Hollywood, ranking behind only Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford. Studio publicists claimed that she was, quote, the daughter of an Arab sheikh and a French woman born in the Sahara, and added that she had spent her early years in the desert under the shadow of the Sphinx. They called her the, quote, Serpent of the Nile, and encouraged her to discuss mysticism and the occult in her interviews. But of course, nothing they said about her was true. She was actually the daughter of a prosperous Jewish family from Cincinnati, Ohio, and had neither been to Egypt nor France. She was, though, one of the first sex symbols of the movies, made even sexier thanks to her alleged connections to the mysterious.
In 1917, the writers of The Devil's Bondswoman, F. McGrew Willis and Walter Woods, produced an even heavier-handed moral lesson with a film called Even As You and I. As crudely subtle as a religious tract, it presents a tempted artist and his pure wife literally bedeviled by demons called drink, lust, and self-pity. The artist is nearly defeated by the devil until his incorruptible bride repels the fiend with her purity. In the same category was another guilt-ridden film called Conscience, directed by Burton Brackman in 1917. In the film, Satan's girlfriend reincarnates on Earth as a rabble-rousing vamp named Ruth, whose mysterious companion, Dr. Norton, is none other than the devil himself. Party girl that she is, Ruth starts breaking hearts and even inspires a suicide along the way. Eventually, an angel, fittingly named Conscience, puts a stop to her shenanigans and decrees that Ruth must be punished with the living memory of her sins, which inspires her to dump her devilish companion and repent. Oddly, Theda Bara was originally set to play the lead role, but she passed. America's entry into World War I allowed for the first use of a satanic film as political propaganda. Metro Studios' To Hell with the Kaiser, not sure who chose that name, was released in 1918, and it revealed the German leaders signed a pact with Satan and had traded his soul for world conquest. The unmissable message of the film is really underscored in the finale when the devil abdicates his throne in favor of the Kaiser, who he acknowledges as being far more evil than he is. The Kaiser was linked with the devil again in the religious epic Restitution in 1918. It was the first of several extravaganzas tracing Satan through the ages. Beginning with a series of earnestly depicted Bible stories, the film shows how mankind has suffered under the devil's bondage since Adam and Eve were kicked out of Eden. Satan then hangs out with Cain, helps crucify Christ, persecutes Christians with Nero, tortures the innocent during the Inquisition, and of course, helps Kaiser Wilhelm threaten America. In the apocalyptic final reel, the devil is bested by Christ, and the spirit of America defeats the Kaiser in the name of God. As dumb as this thing sounds, it was an ambitious production that was shot over a six-month period, and it required 50 different sets to be constructed. The war had put a temporary halt to filmmaking in Europe, but once it ended, directors quickly returned to making horror. The nightmares that emerged from those broken countries led to such classics as Carl Theodor Dreyer's Vampyr and a lesser film that he made called Leaves from Satan's Book, which, though released in 1921, was shot in 1918 as the shell-shocked region struggled to recover. It was based on a novel by a writer named Marie Corelli, whose mystical dramas often incorporated diabolical themes, and this struggle against the devil was no exception. It was in 1921 when Denmark produced the most satanic film of the 1920s. While not an American film, it eventually made its way to our shores, shocking and terrifying audiences. It was called Haxen, and it was released to the English-speaking world as Witchcraft Through the Ages. Haxen is a rarity when it comes to silent films. Even some of the greatest masterpieces of the 1920s can seem creakily old-fashioned to modern audiences. Hampered by a static camera and outdated acting styles that are more suited for the stage than the screen, we have to judge many silent films by the standards of their times, the times when they were made, if we have any chance of enjoying them at all. But that's not the case with Haxen. It's just as clever and inventive as it was in 1921. It's possible that the timeless quality of the film is because it has the atmosphere of a legend or a folktale, offering images that give the impression of medieval woodcuts for which witches and devils were frequent subjects. The sequences of the film that are separate from the plot feature scenes of demonic debauchery that likely wouldn't pass the censors even today. The film was made in a style that blazed the way for cinema to come, bringing to life several documentary-style episodes that trace the history of witchcraft from the legend of the Black Sabbath to the tortures of the Inquisition. Director Benjamin Christensen himself plays the role of the devil. As he presides over a satanic gathering, he's portrayed as a figure of liberation, symbolizing the joys of the flesh and not shying away from erotic images, exposing more flesh than would be seen in any film, satanic or otherwise, for decades to come. The deliberately blasphemous and anti-religion tone of the film scandalized Danish audiences in 1921. Up until that time, even in the years since, there have been few films that dared to wage such a full-on assault on the church like Haxan does. The comical priests and nuns in the film are depicted as deserving targets for the devil's mockery, and Satan is portrayed like a circus ringmaster directing all the fun. It's a statement to Haxan's staying power that when the film was re-released during the occult craze of the 1960s, modern audiences found it as compelling as ever. Distributed to underground theaters, the silent film's old title cards were replaced by the voice of Naked Lunch author William S. Burroughs, which manages to enhance the delirious scenes of deviltry. The jazz soundtrack that was added, though, not so much. So just watch the silent version if you get the chance. I think you'll find that it's worth hunting down. Now, as far as silent films that hold up today go, I want to make sure to mention the classic F.W. Murnau film, Nosferatu. Although it makes no blatant reference to the devil, it is an occult film, thanks to the behind-the-scenes connections of the creators. If you don't know much about Nosferatu, because apparently you live under a rock, it's regarded as the first genuine vampire film. While the names and locations were changed from Bram Stoker's book Dracula, which it obviously rips off, they changed the names to avoid charges of copyright infringement. But the plot and characters are clearly recognizable to anyone who's read the novel or even a comic book about Dracula. The devil never appears in the film, so I won't get into the plot, but we'll encourage you to watch it if you get a chance. For our purposes here, it's not the film that fits our theme as much as the makers of the film do. The sinister undertones of it were the work of Albin Grah, who was a member of Berlin's occult community after the war. He belonged to several occult societies, which led to him becoming an acquaintance of the already mentioned Aleister Crowley. So that was one connection. The other? Little more chilling. Grau was officially credited for the art design, sets, and costumes for Nosferatu, but was also responsible for the concept of the film. During the war, Grau had served in the army in Serbia. He and the other men in his company were staying in the home of a Serbian peasant who told them a terrifying story one night about how his father had returned from the dead in 1884. The man had risen from the grave and terrorized the village until he was dispatched with the traditional wooden stake in the heart. According to the peasant, his father was known as a Nosferatu. Grau never forgot this strange tale and intended Nosferatu to be the first of a series of occult-themed films, but his plans were curtailed by Bram Stoker's widow, who successfully sued the company for that copyright infringement they'd been trying to avoid. It bankrupted the enterprise and doomed Nosferatu to obscurity for decades. From Nosferatu, we return to America in 1926 with Rex Ingram's The Magician, the first film to be based directly on the infamous persona of Aleister Crowley, who I know I've now mentioned three times already. But I can't stress the impact that Crowley had on the 20th century when it came to magic and the occult. Although best known today, thanks to Led Zeppelin and Ozzy Osbourne, Crowley's name was synonymous with the devil in the 1920s popular press. Even though his reputation was built around more fantasy than fact, he was thought of by many as a black magic boogeyman of epic proportions. In 1902, Crowley was living in Paris and working hard to make a name for himself as an eccentric character when he met the Razor's Edge author W. Somerset Maugham. When Maugham later recalled their encounter, he wrote that he took an immediate dislike to Crowley, but, quote, "he interested and amused me. He was a great talker." Maugham turned Crowley into a character named Oliver Haddo in his 1908 book, The Magician. Crowley wasn't thrilled. He later complained about the book and accused Maugham of plagiarism. However, he loved the movie version of the book when it was released and called it, quote, "an appreciation of my genius, such as I had never dreamed of inspiring." He was just a little full of himself. The film, by necessity, simplifies the novel, and the Crowley character becomes even more cartoonishly villainous than he was in real life. The Magician owes its visually creative look to director Rex Ingram, who'd recently turned Rudolph Valentino into a matinee idol. The film did well, but Somerset Maugham made it clear that he disliked Ingram's adaptation of his book. Well, Ingram laughed at this complaint and snapped back, responding to the criticism by saying, well, he'd done the best he could with such poor material. Other European classics followed Ingram's film, each with a satanic theme, including Fritz Lang's Metropolis, the visually stunning science fiction film that showed that Satanism will still be practiced in the gleaming tech vistas of the future. The black magic aspects of Metropolis are a major part of the original novel, which was written by Lang's wife, Thea von Harbau. Now, she usually receives less credit than she deserves for imagining the film's most memorable scenes. By 1926, American innovator D.W. Griffith had outstayed his Hollywood welcome. The triumph of Birth of a Nation was largely forgotten. He was drinking heavily, and while unwilling to adapt to more modern techniques of filmmaking, he was still struggling to stay involved in the industry that he'd helped to create. It probably seemed lucky when he was called to take over for Cecil B. DeMille on the set of a new film until it was discovered that it was based on a tedious and moralistic Marie Corelli novel from 1895. The book and the film were called The Sorrows of Satan, and it follows the devil as he's kicked out of heaven and ends up on earth. Here, he meets a starving writer named Jeffrey Tempest, who is in love with a fellow author named Mavis. Jeffrey becomes bitter after several literary failures, and that gets the attention of the devil, who takes him under his wing and introduces him to London's high society. The devil then leads him down the path of wickedness until revealing himself to be Satan in the final reel. Jeffrey, of course, renounces his diabolical patron and ends up back with Mavis, where he belongs. It's a pretty standard silent film with lots of overacting and melodrama, but Griffith, even this late in his career, brings conviction and artistry to a film that, while it may not deserve the effort he brought to it, remains the best of the satanic films produced in America in the 1920s. By the time the silent era finally faded out, many of Europe's greatest film talents had been drawn to the flame of Hollywood. Among them was Benjamin Christensen, the director of Haxan. In California, he used the devil as his muse for the second time in his career. When he was given the task of adapting A.E. Merritt's best-selling novel, Seven Footprints to Satan, in 1929. Merritt was a popular pulp writer and novelist who specialized in occult-themed adventures set in exotic places. In other words, Indiana Jones 50-some years before Raiders of the Lost Ark. Anyway, in Seven Footprints to Satan, a dashing explorer is kidnapped by a mysterious secret society and brought to their leader, a masked mastermind they call Satan. Although the reader is initially led to believe he's the actual devil, he's eventually revealed to be a mortal criminal genius who's obsessed with satanic symbolism. Merritt's villain, Satan, is every bit as insidious as the most dastardly criminals of the day, and the complexity of the character makes the book better than most other pulp literature of the time. Unfortunately, though, that complexity doesn't make it to the screen.
The film is a watered-down version of the story that plays more like a far-fetched comedy than an adventure story with a dark tone. Merritt, like so many other authors whose stories are mangled by Hollywood, was very unhappy with the transformation of his occult mystery into a farce. Although the screenwriters dropped the ball when it came to plot, director Christensen offered the same kind of visual artistry that made Haxan such a success. Satan's throne room is an impressive sight, with its bat-winged, fire-breathing dragon, slinky harem girls, and the robed and hooded master who looks down on his followers from above. There's actual menace in the halls of Satan's hidden mansion, a lavishly decorated Gothic mansion that illustrates the wealth and larger-than-life presence of its owner. The finale of the film, though, makes it clear why A.E. Merritt hated everything the studio did to his book. The fantastic journey through Satan's realm is ultimately revealed to be an elaborate prank played on the hero. While European horror films never flinched when it came to putting real terror on the screen, early Hollywood always chickened out in the last reel, turning everything into the last few minutes of an episode of Scooby-Doo. It's too bad, too, because the director and the on-screen talent could have made something great. Although the kidnapped explorer was played by Creighton Hale, a half-baked comic hero modeled after the much more popular Harold Lloyd, his dizzy dame sidekick was played by the remarkably talented and always funny Thelma Todd. And threatening the couple was a menagerie of frightening henchmen, a fanged stooge known as Spider, a dog-faced servant, and a dwarf played by Angelo Rizzito, who'd later be seen in Freaks and hundreds of other films all the way through the 1980s. Released just before the start of talking film, Seven Footprints to Satan was initially distributed in a standard silent version. But to keep up with the new craze for the talkies, a sound version was released that same year. The bad news was that it made the film worse by featuring a silly spookhouse soundtrack that included screams, groans, and gunshots. Despite the amazing visuals of Christensen's film, the goofy tone of it makes it a less than great adaptation of a far superior book. But hey, isn't that usually how it works when you compare the book to the movie? There is one last film to discuss in this episode, and oddly, it turned out to be the only major American diabolical film of the 1930s, The Black Cat, which was released in 1934. On the surface, it seems to be just one of the many horror films produced by Universal in the wake of successful movies like Dracula and Frankenstein, which both came out in 1931. And while The Black Cat is enjoyable on that level, there are some secret hidden depths to the film that makes it the most satanic film of the era. Directed by the reportedly very eccentric Edgar Ulmer and featuring two outstanding performances by Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, there are a number of tangled stories here that were woven together to create a film that remains genuinely bizarre after more than 90 years. Universal boss Carl Limley Jr., knowing the kind of money the studio was making with horror films, gave Ulmer a huge amount of creative control on the project. The only condition he had was that the film had to be titled The Black Cat, after the Edgar Allan Poe story. Although bound by the low-budget constraints of a Hollywood B-movie, Ulmer worked wonders with what he had, bringing together a lot of weird elements that shouldn't have worked in one film, but did. The plot, which is dreamlike and strange, is secondary to the atmosphere, but don't let that deter you. There is a story here, although it's definitely not Poe. The story follows the Allisons, a honeymooning American mystery writer and his wife, who are on a train journey somewhere in Central Europe. On the train, they meet the peculiar Dr. Vitus Werdergast, played by Bela Lugosi, who tells them he was a World War I veteran, only recently freed from 15 years as a prisoner of war. After an accident with the train, the Allisons and Dr. Werdergast are forced to seek shelter for the night at the ominous and futuristic home of an engineer, Hallmar Posick, played by Boris Karloff, who happens to be the doctor's former commanding officer during the war. Our introduction to Pulczyk finds him lying in bed with his young wife, Karen, a highly suggestive scene for 1934. But that's only a preview of other parts of the film that definitely push the limits of the Hays Code. We learn that Pulczyk's starkly modern mansion is built on the ruins of a fort and on top of the graves of thousands of men who died there during the war. So, as you might imagine, it's a really cheerful place. Anyway, soon the first plot twist is revealed. It turns out that Dr. Werdegast arranged to be stranded near Pulczyk's home. He's there on a mission of revenge, with plans to kill Pulczyk for stealing his wife and daughter from him during the many years he was in prison. And then, next plot twist. The doctor's daughter, Karen, is now Pulczyk's wife, taking her mother's place after she died mysteriously. And yes, it gets weirder after that. Pulczyk leads Werdegast through the lower levels of the mansion, where he shows them the perfectly preserved bodies of women that he's placed in glass coffins. But who these women are is never explained. It's just one of the mysteries of the film. The biggest mystery, in my opinion, though, is the need for the Poe title for the film. There's only one black cat that appears in the movie, a confusing scene in which Werdegast's fear of cats is revealed. Now, are you ready for the next twist? Because literally, right out of left field, it's revealed that Pulczyk is the high priest of a satanic cult. We see him reading a book called The Rites of Lucifer, which includes instructions on sacrificing a virgin. As members of the cult convene for rituals, it becomes clear that Mrs. Allison is the only virgin on the premises, which makes it clear to me that the honeymoon really hadn't gone that well, but anyway. Pulczyk then leads a stylized black mass, which is the first satanic ritual ever really seen on screen. This scene would have an enduring influence on film, becoming a staple of almost every movie about black magic that followed. Boris Karloff, who may have played Frankenstein's monster, but was known for his great sense of humor, improvised all the impressive sounding satanic invocations used in the film. He later admitted he just strung together some of his Latin that he learned in class in college. So consequently, if you speak Latin and you listen closely, you'll hear Karloff utter some dire phrases like, "with a grain of salt," "in wine there is truth," and my favorite, "beware of the dog." Dr. Werdegast steps in and saves the intended sacrifice victim and breaks up the ceremony. A last-minute save of a female satanic sacrifice victim that would happen often in many films that followed. Finally, the doctor, driven insane by his grief, avenges the death of his wife and the spoiling of his daughter by sadistically stripping the flesh off Pulczyk's body in another attempt to push the limits of the movie code. The hero, Mr. Allison, interrupts this torture by shooting the doctor, who then manages to activate a handy self-destruct button as he dies, as every mansion fortress should have one of those handy. Anyway, it's destroyed, along with Pulczyk and his cult, and the Allisons escape, presumably to enjoy their honeymoon far away from Central Europe. Now, I know you've listened to the synopsis of the film and you may be thinking that it doesn't sound nearly as good as I keep claiming that it is, but I'll ask you to trust me on this. As wild and ridiculous as the story seems to be, some of its strange air of credibility may be because the screenwriter, Peter Rurik, which was a pseudonym for hard-boiled detective writer George Sims, and director Ulmer, based it on a curious news item circulating in the press shortly before the making of the film. As unlikely as it might seem, there actually was a naive young couple who visited the isolated home of a magician and became involved in occult rites that actually involved a black cat. The remote place was the Abbey of Thelema in Sicily, and the magician in question was, of course, Aleister Crowley. And yes, he's back again, but this is the last time. In this episode, anyway.
The story had come to the attention of the press when Crowley, desperate for money, accused Nina Hammett, an author friend, of libel in a London court. She had mentioned Crowley in her 1932 autobiography, and the passage that made him angry was her description of his days at the Abbey. That passage read, "He was supposed to practice black magic there, and one day a baby was said to have disappeared mysteriously. There was also a goat there. This all pointed to black magic, so people said, and the inhabitants of the village were frightened of him." In court, Crowley's attorney had the nerve to say with a straight face that his client was violently opposed to any sort of black magic and was an ardent practitioner of beneficial magic. It's hard to believe this argument had much of an effect on a conservative British jury, especially since Crowley had been tarnishing his own reputation for years by dubbing himself the wickedest man in the world. Rather than vindicating Crowley, the libel suit allowed the opposing attorney to dredge up every outrage against society the magician had produced since the Victorian era. The trial changed from being a libel action to a public expose of Crowley's life. One of the witnesses the solicitor called in to smear Crowley was Betty May Loveday. In 1923, she and her husband, Raoul, had been invited by Crowley to study magic at the Abbey in Sicily. Betty testified to the horror of those in the courtroom and the delight of the press about a ritual she'd witnessed in the Abbey's temple in which a drugged Crowley ordered a cat to be stabbed to death. Remembering the animal's brutal death, she cried that, quote, "My young husband had to drink a cup of that blood." The judge and jury were predictably mortified, and Crowley lost the case. The publicity that followed only confirmed the public's suspicions about his wickedness. It was from that bit of sensational publicity that several of the Black Cat's elements were borrowed. It should be noted, though, that Crowley's Abbey, long shrouded in legend, was hardly as impressive as the mansion occupied by Karloff's Crowley surrogate in the film. The Abbey was actually no more than a dilapidated five-room building in the rugged rural town of Cefalu. Conditions were horrific and filthy, and the lack of electricity or running water was enough to scare away many of the Crowley pilgrims who flocked there to see the wizard. And while the character of Polzig owes a lot to Aleister Crowley, the film's director, Edgar Ulmer, also drew on a more personal source when creating the villain. Before becoming a filmmaker, Ulmer had studied architecture in Vienna. So after he found his first work in the movie business, he met architect Hans Polzig, who designed the sets on the film. Ulmer borrowed his name for the character, but it turns out there was an even greater link between the real Polzig and the one in the film. Born in 1869, Polzig was one of Germany's leading architects, erecting unique buildings on a monumental scale. He designed his buildings, he claimed, through metaphysical means and the occult sciences. Although he was an intensely private man, revealing little about himself outside his small circle of associates, he was one of many in the German art community who studied the magical arts. Polzig and his wife Marlene often held spiritualist seances at their home, during which Polzig's daughter acted as the medium. His library was filled with books on magic, mysticism, and the occult, and those who knew him well stated he could discuss his ideas and philosophies for hours. A young Edgar Ulmer discovered this while working with Polzig on his first movie job. He became an inspiration to Ulmer, even though he considered the older architect to be something of a tyrant. On a much smaller scale and budget, Ulmer and set designer Charles Hall attempted to imitate Polzig's designs on The Black Cat, making the futuristic set of the villain's mansion as important of a character as those played by the actors on screen. As for the film itself, it is unusual among horror films of the 1930s for so powerfully recalling the specter of World War I, which was still a fresh wound for the public. Most Universal horror films offered escapism, but The Black Cat confronted its viewers with recent historic horrors, far more frightening than any movie monster. with its mixture of Satanism, suggestions of necrophilia, and erotic atmosphere, The Black Cat is easily one of the darkest films of the 1930s, although the original version of it was even more sinister. When Universal executives saw the rough version of the film, they demanded cuts, and a comparison between the original script and the finished film reveals that many of the most disturbing elements, including a blatant orgy scene during the Black Mass, were cut out. This last-minute cutting explains some of the inconsistencies in the plot, which the plot makes even less sense every time you watch it. But even so, the well-matched Lugosi and Karloff carry the film, as does cinematography that is so great you'd never know the movie was made on a shoestring in just 15 days. Universal's marketing department deliberately downplayed the satanic elements of the picture, nervous that devil worship might not be readily accepted as entertainment. But even with the editing that was done, British censors still found the film's handling of Satanism to be completely unacceptable. Thanks to this, the British print of the film, which was retitled House of Doom, replaces all mentions of black magic with less disturbing references to sun worshippers, which of course ruins the diabolical nature of the film. And by the way, Britain's guardians of public morality would fight any and all inclusion of satanic themes in movies for a few decades to come. So if you've never seen The Black Cat, watch it. It's out there. And now, knowing a little about the unconnected background stories that inspired it, you can experience the film on several levels at once. But even without these influences, Hollywood's first solid treatment of a cult that worships the devil is more fascinating than any other horror film of the time. I hope you've enjoyed this first episode about the devil in the movies. There will be more to come as the series continues. And while there aren't many of the films in this episode that you can enjoy today, aside from Haxan, Nosferatu, and The Black Cat, you'll eventually be able to compile a satanic watch list so large you'll have trouble finding time to watch them all. And speaking of time, our time this week is up. So, thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. To say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast, and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're just a small business that's grateful for everything you do for us, because we couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you all, and good night, good luck, and I will see you next time, as long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.